Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Adria Bernardi. Adria Bernardi is the author of In the Gathering Woods, a story collection awarded the 2000 Drew Heinz Prize by Frank Conroy. Her novel, The Day Laid on the Altar, won the Bakeless Fiction Prize. She is also a translator of works from Italian and an essayist and teaches in the Warren Wilson MFA program for writers near Asheville, North Carolina. She grew up in the northern suburbs of Chicago, not far from Highwood, the immigrant community where her grandparents first settled. She now lives in Worcester, Massachusetts with her husband and two sons. She'll be reading tonight from her novel Open Work, published by Southern Methodist University. Hi, Adria. Welcome to Prosody.
Hello, Ellen. Thanks.
How about you start out tonight reading something from Open Work?
Okay. I'm going to read from the first part of the book, and I don't think I'll say too much about it. I think I'll just read it. It's about two characters will be featured in this. One is named Imola, and the other is Antenore, and it's the end of the first part of the first section of this book. Mid-morning, she stands at the wash sink chiseled into the side of the mountain. During the night, the rain plinked against the window. Before dawn, the wind changed direction, turning it cold and clear. The wash sink has two deep troughs, one to wash, one to rinse. Water runs continuously through the spigots. In late October, her hands are numb. There's no work left in the fields, and they've collected enough firewood. Leachy and Lydia are at school. If the snow's not too deep this year, they'll go to school all winter. Her girls will know how to write. Imola wrings a towel, wrings it hard. She torques it and drapes it over the lip of the trough. She picks up a second towel and wrings it. Her wedding band slips up and down. The baby is asleep inside. Akile is out in the woods hunting. The stain won't come out of his good shirt. When the air gets dry, he gets nosebleeds. Soon he'll be leaving for the season, digging out rock to make a new road down south near Grosseto. He's already leaving later than usual. A hen walks behind her. It brushes her skirt. Its body presses against her calf. Down the path, the rooster taunts her. You're late. You're very late. It's cold. There's not a cloud in the sky. There's food stored. Money saved. At a corner table in the Moonglow Saloon, Antenore Gemori sits drinking beer with Zeffirini, aptly named, Zeffiro being one of the winds, Zeffirini, a windbag. Antenore Gemori needs more time to decide whether he wants to take a job traveling between small mines in Iowa, Missouri, Indiana, and Illinois to organize small mines the union hasn't gotten to yet. The men there work in dog holes. No support timbers, no ventilation. Men die all the time there, and no one outside knows. The beer was drawn too fast, and they're waiting for the froth to go down. You could make great strides for the worker, Zeffirini says. Come with me, Minnie, Antenore had said. Come with you and do what? She answered. Zeffirini can wait two more days for an answer. But if he doesn't take it, there are others who will. Imola drops a wrung-out towel into the clothes basket. It's Zaccagnier coming up the path. She calls out, oh, you've got nothing to do today but go traipsing around? He does not laugh. He does not wave. He does not shout out, Oti, his usual salutation. In that second of silence, a valley. Between what she had expected him to say and what he was about to say, she felt her face flush, blood rush to her head, then nausea, then weightlessness. Akile out hunting. Zaccagnier slowly climbs the final hill leading to the door. His face is ashen. The creases in his cheeks are furrows. The girls? In his hand, he carries a piece of paper folded, the color of ivory. Antenore Gemori cannot see over their heads. Minucci reaches through the miner's shoulders. His hand searches through their bodies. Minucci's grip is a vise. He says something in a rasp. He repeats it. Stag Canyon. Zaccagnier arrives at the top of the path. Zaccagnier does not speak. He holds out the folded piece of paper. She cannot read. Neither can Sacanier, but he is the messenger, and he knows what the message says. What in the hell are you saying? Explosion. Antenores shoves his way closer. He pushes his way in. Sacanier does not unfold the piece of paper. He recites it. What in the hell are you telling me? There is no list yet, Manucci says. His breath is on Antenores' face. An enormous fist pummels her stomach. Antenore grabs Manucci by the shirt. He pulls him so close their shoulders knock. Her calves and the back of each leg press against stone. Water runs behind her. She has been flung backwards against the wash sink. Antenore's mouth deforms. It twists. It drops so low on his face that the skin stretches thin. Imola drops to her haunches. Her knees gouge her breasts. Black discs drop in front of her eyes. The stone is cold against her back. Sacanier extends a hand. She rises. The mountain wobbles. Antenore shakes Manucci hard to knock some sense back into him. Manucci grabs Antenore's wrists. He wrestles them away and down. It's a disaster, Manucci says. This time, it's a disaster.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Adria Bernardi, reading from her novel Open Work, published by Southern Methodist University. So, Adria, one of the things I was really interested in this book has to do, obviously, there's a lot of landscape that's covered. We go from Italy to the United States, but also the idea of language. And I was wondering, I know that you've translated work, so I'm assuming you're fluent in Italian. When you were writing the sections, you're still writing for an English-speaking, English-reading audience even, but did you find there was a difference in the way that you were working with the language, with the sections that, you know, at least, even though we're reading them in English in our imaginary lives, they're in Italian? Or is it just kind of that your language comprehensively is just kind of influenced by these different rhythms of English and Italian?
I've never really thought about it that way, but it is different.
And how's it different?
I don't know. No, I mean, it's sort of a different, it's almost like sitting in a different chair. You know, I mean, it's almost like being, the brain is,
sure.
The brain is holding it differently. You know, it's like when Adele has it, I mean, when Adele is, you know, you thinking Adele is the, would be basically generationally, she would be Antenore's granddaughter in this book. In the middle part of the book is Antenore's granddaughter. And she is, in the middle part of the book, basically understands but doesn't understand the language. And by the end of the book, she is fluent in the language. But, you know, in the process of writing it, there in fact was a different way of approaching the language.
So would you write maybe a way to probe at it has to do just with the process of writing the book. When you were writing the sections, were there days that you would work just on the sections where it's the characters who are speaking, they're not just fluent in Italian, that's their native language, and then days, or if you were switching between the two, would you have to... You said sit in a different chair. Would you have to literally kind of change your process?
Yeah, and they were actually really different times. They were different periods of my life. I mean, they were, you know, I would be working on one chapter, which, because the book was really written over many years. And so, you know, and so when I was working on Ray's chapter, who is, Ray is Orazio, who changed his name to Ray, who is Antenore's son and Adele's dad. You know, that I was working just on that. And so his concept of the language, I mean, he has a whole different way that he speaks the language. And so as I was writing his language, I guess it's a wonderful question. I've never thought about it this way. But in fact, the way that he uses Italian is completely different. And the way it came out as I was writing it would come out differently in the sentences. You know, the way it would punctuate. I guess his was more of a punctuation.
So it sounds also that it has something to do with how you're listening to the voices of the different characters.
Yes.
So that they're kind of developing the syntax. They're developing yes. because of the way you conceive of them understanding language.
I think so. And I think that that's such an interesting, I never would have thought about it this way, but I think by the end of the book in Adele's chapter, I mean, she thinks in Italian in a way that Ray doesn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, Ray uses it almost as a, it's not synthesized mm-hmm. in the same way. It's just, it's added in.
Well, and they say that, you know, and that I think holds true to real life. They say that when you finally have become fluent in a language, one way or another, it's that you think in it, mm-hmm. you know, even if it's not your native language, that when you can finally think in it and you dream in it, mm-hmm. You know, you've kind of made that bridge. And in this book, there's characters, you know, that are kind of all stages of the process. Well, kind of another question along those same lines, because this is a book that is an intergenerational book. And I'm always interested in those. Maybe it's also because of the stage of my life at this point. There are times when I will pick up the telephone and say hello, and I hear my mother's voice instead of mine saying it. I'm like, wow, where'd that come from? Or an expression of hers will kind of blurt out of my mouth that I've never said before, and all of a sudden I'm saying, I'm turning it. And it's not a bad thing. I love my mother dearly, but, you know, you feel you have your own identity, and then all of a sudden there's this kind of generational something that pushes through. And I wanted to ask you about that in terms of working with characters that are of a generation. It's a much different process than just characters kind of meeting during the course of the story. What were the challenges of that? What were the pleasures of it?
Well, you know, this is something I've thought a lot about, and it is one of the pleasures of it. Because I find it all the time, and it occurs very unexpectedly. For example, I was listening to my sister this morning, and it sounded so much like my other sister that I couldn't believe it, because they've never, to me, sounded anything alike. And I listened again, and it sounded so much like my other sister. And as I said, they've never, to me, sounded anything alike. And it was their voice. It wasn't even their expression. It was really the quality of their voice. Mm-hmm. So there's that, and there's also I've thought a lot about gesture. I've thought a lot about gesture being passed down, and I saw it in my own sons, where I watched one of my sons, and he did this. You know, sometimes you want to look for things, but this wasn't anything I was really looking to see, and he had a gesture that was my grandfather's. Well, actually, no, that was my son, but then it was with my nephew. And it was my nephew had a gesture that was this was my other grandfather, and he had a gesture that was my grandfather's, and it was so remarkable, you know? And you think, I mean, he never met my grandfather, and it wasn't anything that I've ever seen my brother do. So, you know, maybe my brother, in fact, does it. But it isn't one that I've ever associated with my grandfather, so it's now, like, skipped two generations.
So how does that, or what are the challenges of trying to work that out on the page with a family?
I think a lot of it is where, I mean, I've been thinking a lot about this in my teaching and in my own reading, is visual image, that, you know, or visual or sensory image, and that when I realize, oh, you know, when I have that moment of, oh, mm-hmm. then it's like I realize, oh, this is something, this right. is something, and then for me the challenge is, okay, well, how am I going to describe this and find the language, and find the words to do this,
right.
And then I feel like I really have something,
right.
Because then the specific words for it need to be found.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Waite, and my guest tonight is the writer Adria Bernardi, reading from her novel Open Work. Would you read some more for us?
This is a section. I'm going to read another section, which is Antenore. I found myself thinking about him a lot. And this is a section. This is from the middle part of the book, and it involves Adele, his granddaughter, and who is an adolescent, and it involves him and Adele, and they're together. Adele is spending basically the summer with her grandparents because of a family crisis that involves her mother. And the grandparents, basically the kids have been left with their grandparents, and they're trading off. You know, everybody's doing double time with the grandparents, as happens in family crises. And because Ray has to work, Ray is a he's a salesman, and he has to travel. He travels, and Rena is ill, so Antenna has her for the day. And this is a scene from that. The air conditioner above the door is humming. There's a big round mark on the concrete from dripping water. Inside, your bare arms get goosebumps. A man at the stove yells hello from behind the counter. A man at a table and back calls out his name. Antenna clamps his hand on the shoulder of a man sitting at the table facing the door. He asks him about his leg. He asks him in dialect. The man's about your dad's age, except he's completely bald and your dad's hairline is receding. The man stretches out his right leg, bends over, and rolls up the pant leg. The bruise wraps around his calf, and his ankle is taped up. It's a good thing the stone didn't fall from the front, Antenna says. The man says he'll be out another 3 weeks. Antenna pats him on the back, hard. The window seat looks out at the railway tracks. The waitress comes up to the table right away. Who's the young lady here with you today? She asks if Mike, your brother's still playing baseball. She says Teresa, your sister, must be two by now. She asks about Mom and Dad. She and Rena went to school together. Antenna asks her about her mother, Yale. She says Yale has recovered from the fall, but her eyesight is going. It's going to be hell when she can't see anymore. Give her my regards, Antenna says. Let me know if there's anything I can do. They're speaking in English. Antenna doesn't speak half this, half that. He says to order whatever you want. You'd like cereal with skim milk, but you order pancakes. How about some bacon? Okay. And eggs. Okay, scrambled. He orders a cup of coffee, asks if you want coffee too. No thanks, you don't drink coffee yet. The waitress writes it all down with a very sharp pencil, saying, we're in business then. It's never been just the two of you. Someone else is always there. He holds the bowl of his pipe and puffs and lights the tobacco with a match from a matchbook that says Moretti and Magrini Stoneworks. He asks, which part of the paper you want? It doesn't matter. He hands over the front section of the Chicago Daily News. The Viet Cong have shelled positions again from the DMZ. He's reading the sports page. The Cubs are still ahead, but it's always the pitching that's the problem. They're so goddamn cheap. Every year we go through this. When his coffee comes, he picks up the glass sugar jar with the stainless steel lid and pours sugar from the round hole. The sugar pours in a stream onto a teaspoon as he measures out the sugar and turns his wrist. 1, 2, 3, 4. A tiny stainless steel square flap over the hole and slaps shut when he sets it back down on the table. He pours in the cream. He seems like someone who would drink it black. People drop by his table to pay their respects. They act in a certain reverential way you cannot name, like people act with a priest or a doctor. Frank Sinatra's coming from a portable radio at the end of the counter. Little did we know, the plate comes heaped with food, and he takes back the front section.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Adria Bernardi. I'm glad you read that section for a couple of reasons. You set up some good segues in my questions for me, so I appreciate that. The first has to do with the fact that we slip into second person there, where the reader and the character are together in the experiences. And you don't read a lot of second person. And I know just from experiments I've tried myself with it and also teaching, you know, it's a very tricky voice. And so, I'm curious about the choice for that. And then what were the challenges that you found in working in it?
Oh, that's another good question, Ellen, because it's something that the book, I mean, was in second. I mean, there were parts of it that were in second person. You know, as I was writing it, it just certain parts of it just moved there, and I was conscious of it, you know, sort of as it was happening. And even when the manuscript was done, I knew it had to be there because of the urgency of it. And also where it ended up, where the book ends up with a direct reaching out with a gesture to the reader and really with the second person that can be read in different ways. And so the question is that the cop-out? Is that the ambiguous you where the author has not made the decision? So, you know, the writer says, well, it can be anything you want it to be. And that, right, right. And the decision hasn't been made, right? But of course, in poetry, I mean, that's what the you is about.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, when the poet has done his or her work, I mean, that's when it happens, right?
Right.
I mean, and so in fiction, and I think particularly in American fiction, you know, it's just, it's very hard to make that case.
Right.
Because we don't like ambiguity.
Right.
You know, for lots of reasons. I think for lots of good reasons.
Yeah.
You know, because things get murky and the murky places are, you know, lots of bad things happen in murky places and clarity. And so we got, you know, with my editor, we went back and forth on this a lot. And what I ended up having to do was basically go through the manuscript and make my case for second person. And it forced me to go back and basically reexamine every single instance in which I use second person.
Which probably was a good experience, but probably painful too.
It was painful. And now I can say this because I just respect my editor so much. She was, Catherine Lang at SMU Press was wonderful, is wonderful, but my son referred to her as the mean lady. And I said, shh, no, she's not. But it was so, you know, it was just so, it was very difficult because I knew that it had to move, especially in the third part, it had to move to the second person at the end. And so the burden was upon me to say, okay, if it has to move to this place, then you have to prove it to Catherine. I mean, she is the consummate editor.
Yeah.
She is the consummate editor. So if it's going to work, you have to make it work in terms of the form of the book.
Can you read a little bit more for us? Great.
Okay. And this is Antenore again. And this is from the middle part of the book where he is talking about his relationship when he first met the woman who would become his wife, and Desolina, who is Adele's grandmother and Ray's mother. So I'm going to read that. And this is in Italy. He has gone back. He leaves his job as a stonemason on Chicago's North Shore, and things are going pretty well for him, but he learns that his mother's about to die, and he goes back dutifully. He really doesn't particularly want to, but he goes back, and he goes back, and he does not arrive in time. She's already died by the time he gets there. But when he stepped out of the house, the light hurt his eyes. He asked about the people he knew. Egidio's house was empty. Imola, he asked, Lucrezia. I should probably say this. Egidio is the friend who dies in the coal mine disaster, and Imola is his sister. And Imola was the woman who is learning of the coal mine disaster in the piece I read at first. And Imola, Lucrezia, is her sister-in-law. Egidio's house was empty. Imola, he asked Lucrezia, Lenda in giù. Down where? In manicomio. On the plains, in the asylum, she went out of her mind. Her mind was carried away. And Achille, he's down in Grosseto. But it's summer. He should be up here working the fields. Lucrezia made a sound that was a cross between a sigh and a scoff. He had work down there. He took it. And the children? Licia is in Chicago. Lydia left for France. Egidio is in North Africa, building roads across the desert. 11 years old. He went with his uncle Mingin. The house is completely empty. It's bolted inside and out. When Achille comes back, he'll unlock it, and he'll go down again to get his wife. Neighbors began to greet him. He looked in their faces. He struggled to discern who they were. "Oh my God, it's you." The new face replaced the one he remembered, and he reconciled the two faces. His neighbors started calling out to him, "Come over." Lucrezi invited him over on Sunday. He said no, there would be too much commotion. "You think it matters if one more shows up for dinner? Come on now, it's just me and Oreste, our boy Tadeo. You know everybody is going to be there. Mingin's Tulia, Oreste's nieces, the girls, two of them are down in Lucca working as maids, but the other two are back here again." And he looks up over his shoulder, and a beautiful young woman is emerging through the doorway. Her hair is red, like nutmeg, like cinnamon, and she's carrying a glass of wine. He starts to stand up and take off his hat, and she trips slightly at the threshold and puts her hand on his shoulder to catch herself. And he turns around and grabs her other arm. He is holding it just above the elbow. He is touching her skin. Her arm is freckled. The glass of wine is still in her hand, and they both mumble, "Excuse me." The skin above her breast is flush. Her face is flushed. Her hand is still supporting her arm. Her flesh is still against his palm. And he lets go and steps back. Her breasts are full and beautifully rounded under her dress. Antenore and Desolina mumble hellos at the same time. Her hair is like nutmeg, like cinnamon. She smells like spices. Her face is flushed. There are curls escaped around her face. She is wearing a blouse with a drawstring pulled tight across the top of her breast. And her shoulders are covered, but her arms are bare. Her skin is smooth, her eyes are almost black, they're dancing, and when she smiles, her eye tooth is crooked across her front tooth. "At least I didn't spill the wine," she says.
You've been listening to Adria Bernardi reading from her novel, Open Work. Believe it or not, Adria, our time is done. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Al.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Joseph Wilk and Lauren Wolf, with special thanks this week to Josh Richter and Electric Mayhem Studios in Chicago. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP. She had a smile that swerved, she had a smile that curved, she had a smile that swerved all over the It's all wrong, all wrong, all wrong, all wrong. She had a way. It's all right.